The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh, boy, I don't even know how to start today. Just moments before I hit the air, I went into the chat room at NicoleSandler.com on the Listen Live page, where we've got two chat rooms going during the show. There's that one and the one on YouTube. And I went in the Nicole Sandler chat room, where Emma Heidi, who is one of the South Florida chatters in there, informed me that there is an active shooting going on at a local high school. Now, my daughter graduated last June, thankfully, and also thankfully, selfishly, this was not her school, but it's the neighboring school. There's three high schools in our area, and it is one of the three. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. There is an active shooting going on now. I just ran into the other room. I don't have a TV in my studio, so I ran in the other room and turned on the local news just in time to hear that there are victims. That's all we know. There are victims. Obviously, it's still very early. The school is on lockdown. They're saying stay, you know, away from the area. Don't call 911 unless you have an actual active emergency. I mean, it is happening right now. And for those who wonder what kind of neighborhood this is, it's in a town called Parkland. Very nice upper middle class neighborhood in South Florida. I'm just stunned. You know, these things happen on an almost daily basis now. On a daily basis. I'm talking about school shootings. It seems like certainly weekly. But when it hits this close, it's even more disconcerting. And I get viscerally upset each time one of these things happens. I think now that my kid's out of high school, I'm a little less personally not conflicted, devastated when I hear it, because my first thought doesn't go to whether or not my daughter's okay. But then I think of all those kids in a high school here in a suburb of Fort Lauderdale. This is where we are. Unbelievable. And the Republicans' response to it is, yeah, more guns. I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes this week. There was a whole segment on concealed carry reciprocity. They want to make it, I forget the actual name of the law, but they want to make it so that you have a, if you have a concealed carry permit in any state in the union, just like a driver's license, you can take that with you to any other state and have it be valid. So if you're in, say, from Alabama, where it's very easy to have a concealed carry permit, you could take your concealed carry gun to New York City or somewhere where it is not so easy to get one. This is where we're going. This is the NRA who gave Trump untold millions of dollars for his campaign. I'm disgusted. I guess the only good news is I'm hoping Emma Heidi and Call Me Tripp in the chat room, who are both in South Florida. I'll try to check in and look over at the chat every now and then, and you can keep me posted. Or maybe it's better that I don't know. I hope all those kids are okay. Something's got to change. And sadly, Things don't seem to be changing for the better. Today, we're going to talk a bit about healthcare because the Florida Healthcare Summit is this weekend. I've been telling you about it. I will not be here for a live show on Friday because I'll be up in West Palm Beach participating in this thing along with Nina Turner, our guest today, Michael Leidy, who's from the National Nurses United. I think Alan Grayson's going to be there. Alex Lawson, who you heard on the show last week. So, you know, it's all in honor of healthcare being a human right. And that's one of the questions I want to ask Michael Leidy about, because Dennis Campbell, who you've heard on the show many times, you know, UK Progressive magazine, Dennis Campbell, he is coming over from Great Britain, where he's going to do a whole presentation on the National Health is it National Health Service or National Health System? I think it's the National Health Service that they have over there, which is, you know, it's single payer. They have single payer healthcare over there. And we have people over here trying to scare us into thinking that it's not good. Meanwhile, it's so much better than what we have. So we'll talk with Michael Leidy in the second half hour of the show. Before we get there, I thought once again we would do a live and extended version of What's News, shall we?
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh boy is right. After days of not responding to questions on domestic abuse, the president finally weighed in today. Just moments ago, I did not hear the actual words, so I don't have the audio to bring to you. And I know you're really upset by that because I know you love it when I play Trump's voice on the air, right? Yeah, I know you don't. but here's the quote. You ready? I'm totally opposed to domestic violence, and everybody here knows that. I'm totally opposed to domestic violence of any kind. Everyone knows that. And it almost wouldn't even have to be said. So now you hear it, but you all know. Seriously? Happy Valentine's Day, by the way. Does he repeat every single thing he says? He can't just say something once. What does he think? We don't hear him, or his mind just doesn't work that fast? I'm totally opposed to domestic violence, and everybody here knows that. Ugh. So he has now spoken out, and so now you know he is opposed to domestic violence. Right. Onward and upward. The Senate Intelligence Committee, The Senate Intelligence Committee held hearings on Tuesday on the most pressing international threats to America with intelligence community chiefs FBI Director Chris Wray, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, and NSA Director Mike Rogers all in the hot seats. Russia's meddling in the U.S. elections was a big topic of concern, as outlined by Coats.
Frankly, the United States is under attack. Under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States. From U.S. businesses to the federal government to state and local governments, the United States is threatened by cyber attacks every day. While Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea pose the greatest cyber threats, other nation states, terrorist organizations, transnational criminal organizations, and ever more technically capable groups and individuals use cyber operations to achieve strategic and malign objectives. Some of these actors, including Russia, are likely to pursue even more aggressive cyber attacks with the intent of degrading our democratic values and weakening our alliances. Persistent and disruptive cyber operations will continue against the United States and our European allies, using elections as opportunities to undermine democracy, sow discord, and undermine our values.
Nobody there was questioning the fact that Russia and other players are meddling in our elections, but Russia specifically, and Trump is ignoring it. Here's Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I believe in many ways we're no better prepared than we were in 2016. Make no mistake, this threat did not begin in 2016. and it certainly didn't end with the election. What we are seeing is a continuous assault by Russia to target and undermine our democratic institutions. And they're going to keep coming at us.
They're going to keep coming at us. This is Martin Heinrich, the senator from New Mexico, who is really quite impressive in my book, asking an important question.
Have you seen Russian activity in the lead up to the 2018 election cycle?
Yes, we have seen Russian activity and intentions to have an impact on the next election cycle here.
Director Coates?
Yes, we have.
Yes.
Anyone else?
Yes.
Admiral Rogers.
Yes, and I think this would be a good topic to get into greater detail in this afternoon.
The afternoon session was the one behind closed doors, which we were not privy to. But all of them, to a one, to the last man sitting on that dais, agreed that Russia is meddling in our elections. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island asked another really important question, like, has the president directed you to work on this issue of national security, this issue that's so pressing?
Has the president directed you and your agency to take specific actions to confront and blunt Russian influence activities that are ongoing?
We're taking a lot of specific efforts to blunt Russian efforts.
Directed by the president?
Not as specifically directed by the president.
He has asked our agency to cooperate with each of the investigations that's ongoing and do everything we can to ensure that we thoroughly understand this potential threat.
The agency has full understanding that we are to provide whatever intelligence is relevant and make sure that that is passed on to our policymakers, including the president.
As Senator Reid would then point out, understanding a threat is not the same thing as combating it. Let's sum up again. We're under attack. Russian activity is underway. There's no clear strategy to fight back. And the president apparently isn't asking about one.
The president is not asking about it at all. He just doesn't want to know because he thinks it'll undermine his big electoral win if he admits that the Russians were meddling in the election. NBC News' Ken Delanian was talking with Katie Trump more about this issue.
Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, he essentially got these intel chiefs to admit that while they're taking this issue of Russian meddling very seriously, they have not been asked by the president to tackle this problem. He asked them all very directly. They're not doing this under instructions from President Trump. And it's not clear at all how interested President Trump is in this problem or whether he's actually engaged in it. We know from some reporting, in fact, that people are afraid to talk to him about this in the Oval Office because he views this all as an attack on his legitimacy.
Yep.
He calls it a hoax. He calls it a witch hunt. Senator Angus King of Maine complained that some of his constituents don't believe that Russia meddled in the election because of the comments of President Trump.
And he asked those intel chiefs to please relay it to the president that they are two very separate things and they're two things to be taken seriously and not to muddy the waters.
Here's what they were talking about. Senator Angus King almost imploring the intelligence chiefs to make the president aware of the severity of the situation.
My problem is I talk to people in Maine who say the whole thing is a witch hunt and it's a hoax because the president told me. I just wish you all could persuade the president as a matter of national security to separate these two issues. The collusion issue is over here, unresolved. We'll get to the bottom of that. We cannot confront this threat, which is a serious one, with a whole of government response when the leader of the government continues to deny that it exists.
So at that same hearing where I think we've got two really important issues that were being discussed. I'm sure other things were discussed as well. But there was that, the fact that Russia meddled in our 2016 elections. They're doing it in other countries as well. And there is ample evidence to show they're doing it already in the 2018 midterms. By the way, March begins primaries. So we're in it. It's not like, oh, this is off in November. It's happening now. We are in election season now. And it is a deadly, life and death important election. I know we say that, you know, every election is the most important in our lifetimes. But really, with Trump in the White House, nothing is more important than these elections. The other issue is the handling of classified information at the highest levels of our government. We remember Trump on the campaign trail going ballistic over Hillary Clinton and the way she handled her emails, you know, the handling of classified information, where when I don't believe there really was any proof that she ever sent out anything classified in an email. In a way, it wasn't supposed to be sent. But meanwhile, in the Trump administration, they have at least 30 to 40 people at the highest levels of government who are still on temporary security clearance, who another one, a third one today, just left because he was told that he's not going to get permanent clearance. So, in fact, you know what? Let's see. I bet this is Jason again. Hi, who's calling?
I hate to be predictable.
Yes, it is Jason of Simi Valley. What's up?
Jay, I just was calling in to let you know that I listen to you, not on the Progressive Voices app, but on the TuneIn app, the other one.
Right, because I'm on Progressive Voices now at 6 o'clock Eastern. I'm not online.
Yeah, I watch on the TuneIn because I like hearing you live.
Thank you.
And the problem is that you might want to check with them because all of a sudden in the middle of your show, they went through like three other shows.
Oh, no. Well, nothing I can do about that now. And TuneIn, honestly, it's sort of like YouTube. I don't know why it's doing that. That really sucks. But I'll see what I can do about it.
You mentioned the show on Comedy Central with Tony Atamanek.
Yes.
Now, despite the fact we all loathe and detest Trump, I will tell you that show is brilliant.
Really?
It is brilliantly satirical.
I have a hard time laughing at anything about him because he makes my stomach turn so badly that...
Trust me, I can appreciate that. But I do recommend the show because it is quite brilliant and it's just complete satirizing the guy and just making so much fun of him. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend you do take the time to watch one or two. You can watch them online. I recommend it. I think... You know, you can put aside the fact that they are just flagrantly humiliating him at every opportunity.
Uh-huh.
But it's brilliantly written, and the guy who plays Trump in the show just nails it.
Right. No, I've seen him before. So, have you watched the Cartoon President show on
Showtime?
I
haven't seen so much of that, actually. I mean, if I want to, my satire of Trump, I tend to, for my own personal taste, I tend to catch Stephen Colbert, who I think is...
Yeah, well, that's from Stephen Colbert. It's his segment that he does now lengthened into a full-length, I guess, 30-minute show.
I have not seen that, so I can offer no intelligent comment on it.
All right.
I will say that as far as the people I watch these days with all the late-night people, I will say that Colbert's monologue is sanity saving.
Yes. No, we tape Colbert and watch the monologue. So
And we are happy to say also that the other relief to this madness is coming back on Sunday if you have HBO.
John Oliver. Yep.
I'm curious to see the one thing with all this madness going on now. The most interesting thing I just saw come across, which may be BS, maybe not, that the woman, Stormy Daniels, apparently because this guy went out and talked about this whole payment.
Yeah, the attorney, Michael Cohen, now that he's talked about that he spent the money. In fact, I have this story coming up, I think. Or maybe I didn't
keep it. The thing right now is apparently that may negate the non-disclosure.
Yeah, but then she said she's going to talk to Trump about it. So, you know.
Yeah, pay me more money.
Right, of course.
Yeah, all I can say right now is that when we do get, we will survive this and we will get past this. This will go down in history that making the Teapot Dome scandal and such pale in comparison.
Yeah, I hear you.
And Grant was a pretty awful president, too, by the way. I
said before my time.
Way before my time, too. Talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. All right, yeah. See, we take phone calls now in the first half hour. It's a loosey-goosey show, so if you want to weigh in on anything, feel free, 954-889-6410, or you can Skype in at Nicole Sandler. So anyway, back to the hearing yesterday. They were talking about, obviously, Russia's involvement or meddling in our elections, and how Trump has done absolutely nothing because his ego is so fragile. He's afraid that if he admits that the Russians were at all trying to meddle, that it would invalidate the legitimacy of his election, which is laughable to begin with because he lost by more than 3 million votes. Anyway, the other thing is this whole Porter investigation and staffers working at the White House who do not have security clearance. Where am I? I want to go back to my script here because I was reading from What's News. The other issue, again, that was addressed was that of the security clearances or the lack thereof of many working in the White House. Most notably, the former staff secretary, Rob Porter, who was fired last week. FBI Director Christopher Wray directly contradicted the timeline the White House has been pushing when questioned by Senator Ron Wyden.
Was the White House informed that this could affect his security clearance? That's a yes or no.
I can't get into the content of what was briefed.
But what were they informed?
What I can tell you is that the FBI submitted a partial report on the investigation in question in March, and then a completed background investigation in late July. That is, soon thereafter, we received requests for follow-up inquiry. And we did the follow-up and provided that information in November, and then we administratively closed the file in January. And then earlier this month, we received some additional information, and we passed that on as well.
Okay.
And when Sarah Sanders was asked about it, she took her lying to a whole new level. Not Sean Spicer level, like yelling. She just speaks sort of in a monotone. Excuse me, she just lies through her teeth.
As you know, FBI Director Christopher Wray laid out a different timeline than the White House has been telling us, or one that would seem to be in contradiction to the timeline that the White House has laid out in terms of what we knew when about Rob Porter. Can you speak to what the director said? He seemed to indicate that the first that you would have known about this might have been in March, then again in June, then November, then in January when their case was actually closed.
Look, we explained the process extensively last week. The White House Personnel Security Office, staffed by career officials, received information last year and what they considered to be the final background investigation report in November. But they had not made a final recommendation for adjudication to the White House.
She's such a liar.
Because the process was still ongoing when Rob Porter resigned. In the view of Personnel Security Office, the FBI's July report required significant additional investigatory fieldwork before Personnel Security Office could begin to evaluate the information for adjudication. As Director Wray said, information was still coming to the White House Personnel Security Office in February.
She just lies with impunity. Remember yesterday I was talking about gaslighting? The person who was talking about gaslighting was Anderson Cooper, and he's got it right.
Good evening. We begin tonight keeping them honest with the White House continuing their effort to gaslight the American people.
Yep.
Now, if you haven't seen the 1944 movie Gaslight or kept up with your Psychology Today subscription, gaslighting is when someone tries to make you question your own reality and sanity.
Sky's
and
green.
They do this by lying. They do it by speaking contradictions and by denying the reality that you know to be true. So that is how the White House is gaslighting the American people daily in an effort to cover up how it handled the case of Rob Porter. Today, the White House changed its story and tried again to shift the blame for how a man who had been accused of domestic abuse by at least three women, including his two ex-wives, ended up working side by side with the president and at the right hand of the chief of staff. The story magically, conveniently changed hours after the FBI director testified about a timeline that directly contradicted what the White House had said just yesterday. Now, the White House tried to make a case that you shouldn't believe your own eyes and your ears. You should instead believe each version of the White House's shifting narrative.
Amazing.
And you should also believe the White House when it says that the president really cares about victims of domestic violence, even though the president has never actually said that publicly.
He did today, though. We read you that quote. Oh, my God. All right, enough of that. In other news, the House Oversight Committee is now allegedly investigating the Trump administration's employment of Rob Porter, as Committee Chairman Trey Benghazi-Gowdy told CNN's New Day this morning.
Just so that I'm clear, will the Oversight Committee be launching an investigation into this?
We did last night.
Really?
So it's official.
That word probably means more to you than it does to me. What matters to me is that we are directing inquiries to people that we think have access to information we don't have. You can call it official. You can call it unofficial. Those words don't mean anything to me. What means something to me is I'm going to direct questions to the FBI that I expect them to answer. And if they don't answer them, then they're going to need to give me a really good reason. And you'll learn that reason. And you can judge whether or not it's a sufficient reason or not. But unless you're Jack Bauer, you can't make people answer questions. I've been trying for 7 years to get certain people to answer questions without a whole lot of success. We're going to try, and then we could use your help if they say no.
Something about him I just don't trust. There's some other element to this story that I'm not getting. Yeah, there's an investigation, but watch it be about something different and not the fact that we've got all these people working at the White House at the highest levels without the proper security clearance. Can you say Benghazi? All right, here's the story that Jason from Simi Valley was talking about in another story that at another time in history would be bigger news. Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, said he was the one who paid off the porn star that the president is alleged to have had an affair with shortly after his son Barron was born. This is the New York Times' Maggie Haberman who broke this story.
Michael Cohen told me that he had paid that $130,000 payment that the Wall Street Journal first reported on last month. As coming from an unknown LLC that he had set up, but he had not answered any questions about it. He now confirms that he paid it. He says it was money out of his own pocket, that it was not money from the campaign or money that was routed to him or through some other fashion. He said this because it's essentially what he said in response to a complaint the Common Cause filed, the Good Government Group, with the FEC and the DOJ about the nature of that payment. They alleged that it was an in-kind contribution. There was widespread speculation that it was. Look, we obviously have not seen bank records, but Cohen has been Trump's lawyer and working at the Trump Organization for roughly a decade in the time that I've known him, and he was among the most vocal attack dogs on behalf of Trump last year, and he would often chase down information even if it was later deemed false, because he kept saying to people that, you know, even false information could be damaging to him. He would not answer a number of additional questions, though, including why he did this, whether the president knew, when exactly this took place, and so forth and so on. So this will go on, but this is the first time he's talked about it.
By the way, there was another hearing today, one that got considerably less attention than the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday. And it was a House budget hearing where Office of Management and Budget Mick Mulvaney was testifying. And he revealed for the first time the projected cost of Donald Trump's proposed military parade after he was asked by Congresswoman Barbara Lee.
I want to ask you about this military parade that the president's proposing. You know, the parade that is very similar to those held in authoritarian countries like in North Korea. How much is that parade going to cost, and where is that money coming from?
Good question.
We actually have military parades in this country before. I think we had one recently, as recently as the 1990s, or maybe more recently than that. I've seen different cost estimates from between, I think, $10 million and $30 million, depending on the size of the parade, the scope of it, the length of it, those types of things. We've not accounted for it in this year's budget simply because it's come up at the last minute. So we'll continue to work with you folks if we decide to push forward with that initiative.
No, if who decides to push forward? You mean the president?
Yes, ma'am. That's who I work for.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you said it.
We being the administration. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
But of course, you'd have to appropriate funds for it, or we'd have to find funds for it that you've already appropriated.
That would be estimate $10 to $11 million.
Yeah, I think again, the estimates I've seen, they're very preliminary. So it's between 10 and 30, depending upon the length. Obviously, an hour parade is different than a 5-hour parade in terms of the cost. And the equipment and those types of things. So you've asked a straight question. I've tried to give you a straight answer as I have. We've not done much research on it yet.
So
$30 million, and we're looking at these massive cuts. They just released the new budget for fiscal year 2019, and Barbara Lee asked about the budget cuts that really they want to necessary programs. And this is going to segue into our guest today, Michael Leidy, when we're going to talk about health care. Listen to some of the cuts that Barbara Lee lays out here that Trump and company are asking for in their budget.
This budget is really shameful. It dismantles our basic living of standards that Americans have turned to for decades and pushes millions of people into poverty. It will destroy people's lives. Now, let me list a few of these cuts. You
okay.
cut $213 billion in SNAP, $72 billion in disability programs, $3 billion in rental assistance. You cut in half adult employment and training programs. You eliminate, mind you, eliminate the Workforce Innovation Fund. You cut education by 10%. You eliminate the Minority AIDS program. And at the Office of Minority Health, you eliminate this program specifically for people of color to begin to help close these health disparities. You just totally eliminate these programs. You eliminate Tiger Grants, which have created thousands of jobs. You cut $1.4 trillion in Medicaid, and you eliminate education programs important to low-income and students of color, like Gear Up. It's hard to imagine how you can be proud of this budget, Mr. Director, especially since these cuts are to pay for the tax cuts for the wealthy, billionaires, millionaires, and corporations. It's clear to me that you don't care about paying down the debt or
nope.
the deficit, because this budget really shows exactly what this tax scam was all about. So let me ask you about a family, for instance.
You know what? I'm not even going to go into the question, because his answer is purely what you would expect. Basically saying, that they're Republicans and that's how they think. And if we expanded SNAP, then, all those lazy people would just take their foods from food stamps and they wouldn't go out and work. So you cut back. I should let you hear what he had to say.
If you propose continual increases in SNAP and TANF, aren't you just assuming that you're never solving the problem?
You see?
In fact, I think we would all want to see a world where we don't even have to spend any money there, because no one should need the program in a perfect world. And that's
But it's not a perfect world.
We don't get there with this budget, but we do think we move in that direction. That's one of the reasons you see less spending on those types of programs.
But, sir, $7, $8 an hour, people need a little bit of help from their government. First of all, in terms of job training, in terms of job retraining, you're cutting all of these programs in the Department of Labor. You're cutting out the Tiger Grants. You're cutting funds that actually create jobs and economic growth. And so this budget goes in the opposite direction for people who are living on the edge. And believe you me, I understand what SNAP is about. I formerly was a SNAP recipient because I needed that bridge over troubled waters, raising my kids. It wasn't permanent. It was just so I could get through what I was going through. And that's the majority of people in this country. And so to take that away now, and what you want to do is put them in a Depression-era box with food such as food that's high in sodium and sugar content. It's a way that you're trying to make sure that people who are low income, that we don't believe that they have the dignity that they deserve, the way you're reforming and trying to put SNAP into a box now.
That's
and
Congresswoman.
I think it's a shame and disgrace that you're treating low income and working families in this manner.
Yes, it is. Congresswoman Barbara Lee speaking at the House budget meeting this morning to Congressman or former Congressman, Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, on the horrific tax cuts. Budget cuts that they put into the fiscal year 2019 budget. I was looking at an article on the National Nurses United website that goes into great detail on some of the other budget cuts proposed by President Trump. One of the things that I want to speak with our guest about today, I think he's on the line. Michael Leidy, are you there? Uh-oh. Michael? Maybe we will try calling him back again. Let's try this one more time. Michael Leidy is the Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United, where he's worked since...
Hi, it's Michael Leidy.
Oh, hey, Michael, it's Nicole Sandler calling from the Nicole Sandler Show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Nicole. Thank you so much for reaching out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you're going to be visiting us down here in South Florida this weekend for the big Florida Healthcare Summit. And so I thought today was a good time to talk, not only about the summit, but about what National Nurses United is up to and the fight for Medicare for All.
That's right. I'm really looking forward to getting down there. And Florida, of course, is a key state in the nation on healthcare policy. And so this, I think, summit reflects a changing dynamic where folks are looking at healthcare, looking for peace of mind, and say, hey, why don't we expand the program that's popular and works, improve it, and have Medicare for All? And we're in a new period where that really is a possibility.
Do you really think it is? I mean, I was just going over some of the cuts in the administration's new fiscal year 2019 budget, and they want to cut $1.4 trillion from Medicaid. And another $555 billion from Medicare over 10 years. When they're proposing cuts like that, is it realistic to say, but we can get Medicare for All?
Well, here's why I think it is, because when you go after these popular programs, and after the fight last year over the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid had a renewed prominence and popularity because folks realized, geez, this is what's keeping my grandmother in a skilled nursing facility.
Yeah.
This is what's helping disabled people get the care they need. And all of a sudden, it changed people's view of Medicaid. I agree we need to win the fight to prevent those cuts. But what's happened is people kind of first principles are on the table. How are we going to have health care? How are we going to get the health care we need? And so, ironically, the fight to take away benefits raises the profile of the issue and makes people realize, boy, I got to take action if I'm going to get the health care I need. So that's what I think emerged last year during repeal and replace, a demand to not only don't take away what we have, but provide guaranteed health care. And so you look at the surveys and you'll see 70-80% of Democrats support it. You'll see a plurality of Republicans support it. You'll see Republican voters who make under $30,000 a year, 52% say a federal government should guarantee health care. And so there's a changing political dynamic. Businesses are realizing they don't want to be in the healthcare business anymore. It's too expensive. All of those things, if you look at the polling and you look at the shifting, you've got a majority of doctors who support Medicare for All.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that the cuts are going against the tide, and we're the tide.
Yeah, well, I think it's what the people want. It's getting our elected officials to listen to us and understand it. And that's where, you know, that's where the voters come in, and that's where the activism comes in. Now, you are the Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United. For those who don't know, tell us a bit about National Nurses United and the California Nurses Union.
Well, the California Nurses Association has over 100,000 members in California, and we were the first union to win safe staffing law that limits the number of patients a nurse can care for on her shift. And that is a seminal and transformative piece of legislation that has drastically improved working conditions for registered nurses in California. We started National Nurses United in 2009. We're now the largest registered nurse organization in the country, and we're devoted to Medicare for All as part of a patient advocacy agenda. And the really founding principle of the union is that nurses are in alliance with the public to guarantee health care based on people's need, not their pocketbook. And that is at the heart of our mission organizationally. And we've organized nurses in Florida. We have a number of hospitals where we represent nurses, and we're very engaged in the healthcare reform movement. So it was natural to work on the Florida Health Summit. We organize all over the country. We have nurses in every state. We have collective bargaining contracts throughout the southern states. So this really is a national movement. And RNs, registered nurses, will tell you that there is no stronger advocate for safe staffing and patient advocacy than National Nurses United. And that's really our mission.
You know, you mentioned Florida is a good market. I forget exactly how you put it. Florida is a tough place. First of all, it's such a big state that there's a lot of different media markets within Florida. But we do have a healthy, forgive the pun, population of people on Medicare who know how the system works. We also have a lot of people who are like myself. I'm dependent on the Affordable Care Act. I'm one of those people who, and I'll be telling my story at the Florida Healthcare Summit this weekend, a couple of years ago, was diagnosed with lung cancer. And if not for the Affordable Care Act, I'd probably be dead by now. Because that's the only reason I had insurance. I'm somebody who's worked in radio my entire life. These days, the radio industry has gone the way of a lot of other industries. Excuse me. And, you know, what I do my show online, so I'm self-employed. Without the Affordable Care Act, I'd be unable to get insurance. Now, we have a president who has done everything he can to kill the Affordable Care Act, but it's still intact, even though they've whittled it away. But many of us are unsure about how we're going to get insurance in 2019. So my long-winded question here is, I know that the ACA is far from perfect, but should we be fighting to retain what's left of it now in addition to fighting for Medicare for All?
Well, we should. We should be fighting to expand Medicaid in Florida.
Yes.
And we should, because you're right, Nicole, and I'm very sorry about your diagnosis, and so happy that you were able to get the care you need and be treated. And it's a tragedy. It's a reflection of an inhumane healthcare system that we're at this place where we have to rely upon the private insurers that are, you know, at the heart of the Affordable Care Act. When really they're not acting in our interest. They deny claims. We've got these high out-of-pocket costs, and we're kind of stuck with, well, geez, this is the best you can get under the current system. So, of course, we have to not lose it. The only question, I think, really is how can we go beyond the Affordable Care Act, because it's not sustainable. That's the problem. It's
right.
Not politically sustainable. But also with these escalating premiums and out-of-pocket costs, it's not financially sustainable. And really, self-employed folks like yourself are the ones greatest beneficiaries of Medicare for All, because it takes it out of your responsibility. We pay a little tax right on our check, or the self-employed, you know, make a contribution to Medicare. And via the, you know, via taxes, and that's it. We don't have a copay when we go to the doctor. We can go to any doctor. We don't have a high deductible we have to meet. We've contributed, because it's not a, you know, it's not free in that sense. We, of course, contribute through our taxes, like we do for Medicare. But it's so much less than we're paying now.
Right.
And the care, you can really get care, not just have coverage, because coverage isn't care. Right? We don't know if our insurance is really going to be there when we need it.
No, we don't. And even though I had coverage, and luckily, I'm knocking on wood laminate here, you know, after a lot of hassles and fighting and hours on the phone and dealing with it, most of my bills got paid and we caught my cancer early. So I'm now cancer free. But there's still the ongoing you know, things. And because of the Affordable Care Act and all the changes, I had to change policies. So now I get to start all over again and try to get doctors, to get referrals, to get to the specialists, to get the CAT scans that I need and all that stuff. Where with Medicare for All, it would just be there. And the thing that, you know, I like to point out that it seems like too many people don't, is we're not asking for anything for free. First of all, we pay into Medicare our entire adult working lives, just like we pay into Social Security. These are not, I hate the word entitlements. These are insurance programs that we pay into. They're earned benefits that we'd continue to pay into, right? Just make it a lifelong thing.
Right. This is shared responsibility. This is actually, conservatives should love this. Everyone contributes. No one, but you don't, you know, and so it's not just for those, you know, we often hear from conservatives, folks, middle class folks, well, I'm not getting a subsidy and all these other people are.
Right.
Well, you know, and so why should I, you know, support that? Well, this is the answer. Everybody in, nobody out. Everybody contributes based on their ability, and we all benefit. And it's free when you go to get care, but of course we've already paid. That's the point. We've already paid for care. It's not a barrier to getting the care we need, and clinicians are deciding that, not the insurance company bureaucrats. So it's a mostly privately delivered system with shared responsibility, with clinicians in charge. Those are conservative principles that we often hear from the other side. We want doctors in charge. We want to, you know, have patient choice. We want to have patients at the center of the healthcare system. Well, all those things are what Medicare for All does.
You've been at the forefront of the fight for Medicare for All. In fact, in California, you helped, we're speaking with Michael Leidy of National Nurses United at nationalnursesunited.org, who will be down here in South Florida this weekend for the Florida Healthcare Summit. And you can find out about that event at floridahealthcaresummit.org. You helped spearhead California's Healthy California Act, SB 562. It looked like it was really going to go for a while there, and then it sort of fell apart. What happened with that?
Well, it got too real.
Ah.
Because here's the thing. You know, 70% of Democrats support Medicare for All. In some surveys, it's as high as 80%. And yet, you know, most Democratic politicians will say they support it, but then when you actually get to the rubber meets the road, all of a sudden they have a lot of excuses. Oh, well, my insurance agent friends are going to be put out of work, or can we really afford it? And so you find that support to be quite broad and very thin, and that's what happened in California. The Speaker of the Assembly got pressure from his more conservative members and from the more conservative Democratic governor, and was told, you can't let that thing go forward, because the elected officials know if they actually are put on the spot and have to vote on this, it's a very difficult thing for a Democrat to vote no on. So the easier path is just to stall it, hide mm-hmm. it, and make sure it doesn't move. And that's where we are in the California Assembly. We had a hearing last week on universal coverage, options for universal coverage. And we said, no, this isn't an option for universal coverage. This is a way to guarantee health care. And that resonates. We even had a survey done, Nicole, where we gave them all the anti-arguments. Oh, it's going to raise your taxes, ration care, whatever. These are not true, but there are arguments used against it. Still, 58% of Californians supported it. This is a matter of time here, and we can do it in California. It's a Democratic governor. It's a Democratic legislature. They got to take a stand for guaranteed health care. There's no excuse. And we've been organizing in every district. We have an assembly. It's the same as the House, same as the Florida House. Mm-hmm. That California Assembly, we've been organizing in all those 80 districts. And we have turned out thousands of people to actions in California. The legislative leaders thought we'd go away by now, and we haven't. And that's because they're nurses. They're relentless. They never give up on their patients, and they're not going to give up on this issue.
So it's still alive. It's
still alive.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not. It's stalled. It's being held in this what's called the Rules Committee, but it could be released at any time, and it could move through the legislature if there is political will.
Ah, there's that political will thing. Now, on the national, there was the in Vermont too. They came close to having some sort of a single payer system enacted, and that one also just didn't quite make it. But they had a Republican governor, didn't they?
No, they had Peter Shumlin as Democrat. Uh-huh. He was reelected in 2014. They had passed the program in 2011, and he hadn't implemented it. Between 2011 and 14, he didn't implement it. So when he got barely reelected in 2014, the political dynamic had shifted. The bottom had fallen out, and they weren't able to implement it. He said it was a question of money. It was a question of politics. He didn't have the political support in 14 that he had in 12 and 13, and he didn't act when he had that support, and they paid the price. There are some difficulties doing single payer in a small state like Vermont that a big state like Florida or California doesn't have. And we believe in California, the sixth largest economy in the world, we can set up a healthcare system just like other countries have, France, Canada.
Right.
And it will work just as well, which is much better than ours. And Florida, similarly, Florida has the resources, if they were to direct it,
to set up a Medicare for All type system there. But more importantly, as you say, in Florida, a lot of retirees, we go to Medicare for All. That ends necessity to buy a Medigap policy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to spend that extra $100, $130, $150 every month on Medigap. You have no more copays when you go to the hospital. Many seniors go into what's called Medicare Advantage plans because they cover dental and vision.
Right.
Well, Medicare will now cover that directly. You won't need an insurance product to get those benefits because everybody will have them. It's a much, much better deal for seniors.
Okay, but to let me play devil's advocate here for a moment, though, because now you're talking about a lot of money. The reason that and my husband has a Medicare Advantage plan for the same reasons you mentioned, plus it's cheaper than a Medigap plan. It's far from perfect. You do have co-pays and things like that.
And a limited network, don't you, Nicole, too?
Very
you
much
only
so.
Go to certain doctors.
Very much so. It's similar to, you know, the crappy insurance I have, but it's coverage and we're on a very tight budget. But so these things cost money and more than what we've paid into it. How do you make up for the gap? Where does the extra money come from?
Right. We're doing a fiscal analysis of Senator Sanders' bill, Senate Bill 1804.
Mm-hmm.
We think you're essentially the overall healthcare system is about $3.3 trillion, of which about 60% comes through government. It's less than that that comes through the federal government because, of course, the states contribute through Medicaid and other programs. So, you know, you're looking at maybe around $1.5 trillion or so existing through the federal government. Wouldn't need to necessarily double that because we've estimated that a single-payer Medicare for All type system could save at least 18% from our current spending. That's what we saw in California. We'll see that nationally when that study comes out. So so you're looking at maybe, you know, another $1.2 trillion or so. That can be accomplished through expanding the existing payroll tax that we pay for Medicare. And there are some other ways to raise that money. One idea that's in the House version of Medicare for All would tax Wall Street to pay.
Is that the Robin Hood tax?
The Robin Hood tax, exactly. The Robin Hood tax could be used to help offset these costs. It's also true that we've come up with a financing program in California where 80% of small businesses, including individual proprietary companies, wouldn't have to pay anything because they could be exempted, and we could still collect sufficient monies from those basically large employers who are already spending.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're able to do is those who are already spending for healthcare will contribute, but much less. We estimate businesses could save as anywhere from 5.5% to 22% of payroll if we go to this type of system. So the savings are enormous. The ability to control costs going forward are significant because we'll be able to set and negotiate rates for services as well as for prescription drugs, medical devices, and hospital charges. So no way. Right now, none of those prices are regulated.
Right.
Insurers can charge whatever they want. Hospitals, right? You know, there's drugs. And now we need it. If we go to a system of Medicare for All, we'll be able to control costs after we've saved money. So the financing is very, very doable.
A week or two ago, a new plan was announced by CEOs of JPMorgan Chase, Amazon, and Berkshire Hathaway that they're forming their own new healthcare company for their employees. I mean, it's almost like a mini single-payer plan where they'd all be self-contained, but you're looking at these three, you know, gigunda corporations. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a bad thing because, look, somebody is going to make decisions on our care,
mm-hmm.
the kind of care we get, you know, standard of care and so forth. Would you rather have clinicians, doctors, and nurses making that decision or corporate CEOs? And we tend to think that those corporate CEOs are not going to look at healthcare the same way a nurse would. And that is a concern. They're not going to be able to change the system. They may be able to make it better for employers. That's not the same thing. Employers, actually, they've seen premiums go up, but they've shifted most, if not all, those costs to workers. It's workers who are paying more for healthcare.
Right.
Yeah, the employers get charged more, but it's the workers who are paying it. And I don't see those CEOs looking out for the interests of the workers.
I hear what you're saying. They're going to look out for their bottom line. They're going to do whatever is going to cost them less. And it's probably with the numbers of employees they have, cheaper to self-insure and keep a firm hand on the scale so they decide who gets what treatments.
That's exactly what they do. That's what every large employer in the country already does. They self-insure. And so it's just a means of controlling coverage and benefits. And it's just not a system solution. And in fact, it brings an industry model to what should be a caregiving profession that's been overrun by the profit motive and the imperatives of an industry approach. So it's exactly the opposite.
I'm on Twitter. I know you are as well, at MLighty60. Yeah. Just the other day, a few days ago, I started seeing all these tweets about a new group called United States of Care. you're laughing. It's purported to be a bipartisan group pushing for major health care reform and universal coverage. And Andy Slavitt, who was the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid under Obama, I actually thought was one of the good guys. But apparently this is not what they're putting themselves out to be.
Well, look, Mr. Slavitt, was committed to a private insurance-based system.
Mm.
That's what the Affordable Care Act is. That means the insurers can basically decide what care we get. The insurers, the Aetna medical director admitted he didn't look at the patient's medical histories for claims he denied.
That's amazing.
That's the industry model that Mr. Slavitt put in place. So it's ironic that the people who brought us the private insurance model, corporate health care, and managed care are now going to save us without engaging in politics. How do you win health care justice without organizing politically? It's a fantasy, and what it does represent, though, is a recognition that it's actually the financial barriers to care and the inability of people with insurance to get the care they need that is the problem. And in that sense, he's recognized how the system has been distorted by the drive by CMS and the Office of Management and Budget when they were implementing the Affordable Care Act to have more skin in the game by patients. Their by design was to increase the cost of health care to individuals so they would use it better. But that's absurd. People in the U.S. do not use more health care than in other countries. We simply pay more for it. And the United States of Care needs to recognize that the reality is that you cannot, in a private insurance-based system, control costs, because the insurance companies fight with the drug companies, who fight with the hospitals, who fight with the insurers, to get their piece of the dollar. And it's precisely that revenue war that raises prices and leaves costs out of control. The United States of Care isn't going to address any of that. And I just think it is, again, a misplaced effort to try to come up with a silver bullet for a healthcare system when we could simply rely upon the one program that's popular and works, and that's Medicare.
Medicare for all. Michael Lighty, again, is with us. You're going to be delivering a keynote speech on Friday, I think, at lunchtime. What are you going to say to people?
Is it Saturday?
I don't have the schedule in front of me. At lunchtime, I don't think the problem is in convincing the average person. Look, I, at 58 years old, I'm wishing I was 65 so I could get on Medicare. You know, I've got a number of years. I'm in that really weird donut hole, if you will, where it's going to be a while before I can get Medicare, and I may be without health insurance for a few years if Trump gets his way. How do you get people excited to believe this can really happen?
Well, to understand that we have the people on our side, and what's extraordinary, Nicole, I've never seen an issue like this where elite opinion either is negative or doesn't pay attention. Where Democrats support it superficially, but when push comes to shove, they walk away. And despite all that opposition, despite all the industry opposition, despite the media either blackout or outright hostility,
A majority of Americans want Medicare for all. That's amazing if you think about it. The people get it and elites don't. That's the advantage we have. And I think that that changes the whole politics of it and the whole potential for change. So people, you're right. Those who are most vulnerable are precisely people around our age who are not yet eligible for Medicare, mm-hmm. worked our adult lives, tend to have maybe more health conditions, can't afford insurance, and so are stuck.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that we absolutely need to address immediately. One good reform would be to lower the Medicare eligibility age to 50, just auto-enroll people at 50.
Yep.
And in fact, the insurers would probably like that because that's the patient population they have to spend more money on. I think those, you know, so we need to look at how at Medicaid expansion. Let's expand the existing public programs, not private insurance, but again, you know, social insurance. Those kinds of reforms could expand the kind of system that would be the basis yep. for Medicare for all.
Michael Leidy, Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United. I look forward to meeting you in person this weekend at the Florida Healthcare Summit. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you. I really appreciate your input.
Oh, likewise, Nicole. Thank you. Look forward to seeing you.
Me too. Take care. Travel safely.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow with Howie Klein.